Welcome to Tilt Talk Radio. Today we've got a special episode. We're talking with Leah Doozy, with Compliance Services International. We'll be talking about the ESA. And so with me today, as normal, is Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilties out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, both with Tilt Agronomy. All right, so it's been a topic we've talked about on the podcast before, and so we thought we'd bring in an expert to talk about it with us, and so we're going to welcome Leah Doozy to the podcast. Welcome, Leah.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here today.
We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning. So, Leah, you are an ag economist and principal consultant with Compliance Services International, and you provide administrative and technical support to the FIFRA Endangered Species Task Force. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. We are a regulatory and environmental strategy consultancy based out of Lakewood, Washington.
Okay. So I guess to start then, what is FIFRA? I think we've talked about it a little bit, but...
So that's FIFRA is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. And I always, even after I've said it a million times, I have to go back and ask myself to make sure that I get it right. So under FIFRA, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, governs the registration, labeling, distribution, sale, and use of pesticides in the United States. And so that's all pesticides, whether that's conventional pesticides or that's biopesticides. They regulate all pesticides.
Okay.
I like that rodenticides in there. I don't know why that we don't. I mean, it's obvious we need rodenticides, but how much out of those that you listed is there certain ones that you say specialize in? Out of those,
no,
or is it all of them? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we cover all. As a company, we handle any product that's regulated. So we even work with products outside of pesticides. But within the pesticides, within the ag community, we work with all products. So all products go through FIFRA.
Todd has a soft spot in his heart for warfarin because of the rodenticide quality, I think, because he went to UW-Madison, yeah, and that's sure. Where it was developed. So
they did talk about warfarin a lot, yes.
Yes, I imagine they would.
Yeah, they did.
There is actually, one of the only uses for warfarin right now is feral hog control. I think there is a product that's registered for feral hog control. It's not widely used, but there is a product.
Wow, interesting.
Hog control.
That makes total sense, because... up until you just said that, I always thought they just shot them. It was about the only way you could control them. Which
that trap and shoot, that is the, I think, predominant method. But there is a rodenticide for feral hogs. But
it's good to know.
Pretty rare. Yeah.
All right. So Todd and I both were in North Carolina, where you gave a presentation about the ESA, and that's something that we've, like I said, we've talked about it on the podcast here. We've heard about it at meetings and lots of different stuff. So I guess, what is your take on ESA, or what is the ESA, and how is it going to affect farms?
Yeah, I think that the biggest part about the Endangered Species Act, or ESA, that's important when it comes to pesticides is understanding why are we even talking about ESA, right? Like, most people have an idea of where the Endangered Species Act comes in. Maybe you understand when wetlands, or maybe the building a bridge as it relates to those government projects, those large government projects. But actually, because pesticides are registered as a federal action by EPA, it falls under it requires a Section 7 consultation under the Endangered Species Act with the services, or the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is part of NOAA Fisheries, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is part of the Department of Interior, on any action that may affect species that are listed, federally listed, as endangered and threatened. So that means that it's any action. So even for people that may be familiar or have gone through programs with NRCS where they're using federal dollars to implement conservation on the ground, even those have to go through some level of informal consultation because it's federal dollars, especially if it may impact, say, a stream crossing or something where you're maybe impacting the waterway. Those also go through what's called informal consultation. So all federal actions where it could potentially impact species have to go through Section 7 consultation with the services.
So once they go through that consultation, then what's the next step?
Okay, so the way I think, let's, I'll back up just for a second. So sure. Under FIPRA, EPA registers pesticides, and pesticides have to go through that registration process. Part of that is what's called a biological evaluation. And in that biological evaluation, EPA identifies any potential risk to federally listed threatened and endangered species. And once that process has happened, then the product goes to Fish and Wildlife for them and National Marine Fisheries Service to be able to evaluate it at the biological opinion process. So this is a long process. And one of the reason why we're even talking about it now is it's not new to pesticides, right? EPA is always supposed to be consulting under FIFRA. However, that hadn't really been happening as quickly as other that people would want it to happen. And so there have been lawsuits. And in 2022, in order to help alleviate some of that, EPA started putting in place a work plan and then a work plan update to be able to address ESA earlier in the process, hoping to eliminate some of the litigation that was occurring related to how they were handling consultation and that part of the pesticide registration. So once all of that happens, and especially because what we're talking about is we're talking about all pesticide registration. So that would be registration of pesticides, new products, new uses, but it's also the registration review process. All pesticides have to go through a registration review process every 15 years. And so we're really talking about kind of two different processes, one for new products and one for products going through registration review. So it's all going to end up on the label. And that's, I think, the real key for probably your listeners is it's going to end up on the label, and then the growers are going to have to meet those requirements on the label, just like they do now. It just may look a little different.
So as we know, dicamba was vacated, and, those, and that, yes. That's the biggest, I guess, impact that we've seen of it. Was that the really the biggest catalyst, or was there stuff before that that where that was just the tipping point, or?
Yeah, there was a mega suit that occurred. I don't have my dates right in front of me, but I think it was 2011. So there was a mega suit, and it covered over 100 products, like 100 active ingredients. And so that was filed in 2000, I think it was 11. I would have to go back and look. But it really didn't get settled until 2023. So what we see in that mega settlement, in the mega suit settlement, is very similar to what we're seeing. So it was really that mega suit that was sort of the driver okay. for all of the work plan, the work plan update, the strategies, all of those deadlines that EPA is trying to meet. Those are all stipulated in that settlement from the mega suit.
Okay, so this has really been a process of over a decade of yes. court work and everything else.
Yes.
That's yeah. very interesting, because we always look, I want to say it was a California court, District 9 is what I keep thinking. I don't remember what it was exactly, but that was one that all comes to our mind and farmers' mind because of that very specific dicamba lawsuit. So it's very good to know that this is much bigger than that. This has been happening longer than that, and there's more going on than all of us knew.
That's the, I think that for those of us who exist only in the pesticide space, right, where we only do the regulatory side of pesticides, I think that this is, we saw, this is, my boss will tell you, this is the eighth iteration, right? So EPA has tried to address species before. In the late 90s, early 2000s, there were county bulletins that were paper that would be in offices that went through different products. So this isn't the first iteration of EPA trying to do this. It's actually, I think, the eighth. And so we're hoping this time we can continue to move forward, because regulatory certainty is good for everyone, right? Like, it's good. The dicamba, I think, is a prime example. Growers want to know what they can use. They want to know what's going to be on the shelf, what's going to be available to them. And we really need regulatory certainty. So I think the implementation right now of the strategies and moving forward is really important, so that growers do continue and end users have that regulatory certainty that they're going to have the products that they need and new products that they also need.
Yeah, you mentioned the mitigation strategies. We've talked a little bit about them in the past on the podcast here, but what have you seen, I guess, as this process has gone on with the mitigation strategies? Obviously, they've been adding new ones even fairly recently. to the list of what, you know, counts as a mitigation strategy. So in your opinion, what are the mitigation strategies looking like as far as the impact on farmers? Is it something that will be pretty easily manageable, difficult to manage? Is it going to depend on where you are?
I think that's the million-dollar question. One of the things that I think, we have two strategies that are final, so kind of larger strategies. The herbicide strategy is final, and we've seen it partially applied to Liberty Ultra, the new BASF product. And then we have a final rodenticide strategy, which most people have not, unless you exist in the rodenticide space, you probably aren't as familiar with it. It's a little bit different than the other strategies because the route of exposure to species is very different than it would be for an herbicide or insecticide. And so we're waiting on the insecticide strategy. They did, the courts allowed for an extension on that. It was due at the end of March. It is now due, I think, at the end of April. And so we will be seeing that final insecticide strategy came out. If we'd have had this podcast when we were talking about the draft herbicide strategy, my answer would be very different. Sure. The draft herbicide strategy was going to be very difficult for growers to meet. I went through it with my dad. My dad's a farmer in Georgia. I went through the strategy with him, and we were concerned. Like, my dad's a row crop grower, uses conservation practices, and we were worried that we were not going to be able to meet the requirements of what we call a 9-point product, right? So in the strategies, products are for runoff and erosion control, right? We're talking just about runoff and erosion. Products are going to have anywhere from 0 to 9 points is the way it's laid out in the herbicide strategy right now. So when we talk about a 9-point product, that would be the product that would have to have the most mitigation for using that product from a runoff and erosion standpoint. In the final herbicide strategy, that changed. And EPA did listen to growers. They listened to the registrants. They listened to stakeholders. They listened to all the people who were providing them information and saying, hey, listen, we need more flexibility. Growers are out there doing really good things. They just don't all look the same. And we need to make sure that we have enough room. So EPA added in what they call the runoff vulnerability relief points. I call it a baseline because that's basically what it is. It's where you're starting from. So that can be either 0, 2, 3, or 6 points, depending on what county a grower lives in. So that's never going to change. That's kind of your baseline. They also added in field characteristic points, so the slope of the land and the soil type, which really benefits, I would say, like in the central sands of Wisconsin, where it's really flat, it's going to benefit those growers because they have sandier soils, and they also have a flat land. And so that's going to benefit them. And then they added in a lot more conservation practices. So I talk about them as conservation practices. They're actually mitigation measures, is what EPA calls them. And they have different point values. But the ones people are most familiar with are going to be your conservation tillage, your cover crops, contour farming. I'm trying to think of ones that really are, since I lived in Wisconsin, I do actually know a little bit about the agriculture there. So you've got your filter strips, your contour strip cropping, grass waterways, things that growers may have already put in through NRCS or under their own, because they wanted to. And then you've got other edge of field practices, so riparian areas, so where growers have left a riparian area around their streams and rivers, those would count for points. Tile drainage, especially if it's controlled drainage, there are exemptions. So for all your cranberry growers, cranberries in a bog would be exempt from runoff and erosion points. They wouldn't have to meet those mitigations. So there are places for exemptions. In general, for a lot of growers, especially for growers who are using conservation tillage, no-till, who are using cover crops or growing, which isn't as common, but growing a double crop, those are dryland farmers as well. So you get points for being dryland. Those growers were easily going to meet the 9 points. Where it gets a little more difficult is for specialty crop growers, where maybe you have to use some form of tillage. Cover crops don't work as well. And that's where you're really going to have to get down at the field level and look at what the field looks like and what the attributes of that field are, what's already out there, what conservation practices are they already using. So I think that for a lot of growers, it's going to be fairly easy because they're already doing it. For other growers, especially some of the specialty crop growers, it might be a little, maybe just require a little more effort to figure out how many points they have.
And when you mentioned the point system, I and you can correct me, yell at me, do anything you want if I'm wrong, but I think when we saw you talk a few weeks ago, you had mentioned that it's not cumulative. So if you're using multiple products, you don't have 9 points for one product, 8 points for another. You don't need 17 points because of the combination of the two. It's only 9 points and it meets whatever the point level is.
Yes, absolutely. It is not cumulative. So if you use a nine point product and you use a 3 point product, you're still at 9 points. Same way with, I think the best way to think about it is it's how it is now with, say, buffers, right? So spray buffers. So if you're using three products, one doesn't have a buffer, one's got a 25-foot infield, and then you happen to be using something with a 300-foot infield downwind spray drift buffer, you're at 300. It's not additive. So it's that same concept.
Okay.
Lee, I think that that's very helpful to farmers. We've run this on a few farms just to see how it's going to affect us and what we're going to have to do. And I think you hit it on the head that there's going to be farmers affected. However, there's, in general, your farm probably will be okay. You might have to implement one new thing, maybe two new things, but overall the point system is very helpful, and to know what your sort of baseline points are. What would your recommendation be to a grower out there? Should he run it on every field? Should he try to group fields? Should he run it across sort of the whole farm, maybe his worst case field? What have you seen to make this process maybe a little bit easier for somebody trying to implement on their farm?
So what I've done, that's a great question. I think that I think for me, that's kind of the first step, is thinking through, because you've got time, right? Like, we only have one product that has I guess Endless One Duo has points as well. It just looks a little bit different. But Liberty Ultra is really the first one to go through the herbicide strategy. So what my approach has been is with my own farm, is that I grouped everything. So I said, okay, what is my production system? So what does that look like? So I'll use my own farm as an example. My dad grows corn, soybeans, wheat, canola, barley, oats, sunflowers, and short grain sorghum, right? So we have a very diverse cropping system. So I like to think about, okay, we may have corn and soybeans with a fallow, probably fairly rare, but we may. Or we have corn and soybeans with a cover crop. Or we have corn and soybeans with a double crop, regardless of what that double crop is, right? So it doesn't matter which one it is. We just know we're going to have a double crop in there, because they're all managed kind of the same, except for canola, right? So we do some light tillage before we plant canola, because we need good seed soil contact, right? So that's one that's going to be a different production system. So I kind of set that one aside. So I group things by production systems. So is it irrigated? Is it non-irrigated? Do I have a group of fields that has tile drainage and a group of fields that does not have tile drainage? So I like to think through all the different parts of the mitigation menu that can be grouped together. So I may have my production system for, 25 fields are going to be dry land, no tile drainage, corn soybean rotation with a cover crop. And then doesn't matter which field it's on, I know how many points that production system has. And so I like to approach it from a production system standpoint. And then for the production systems that don't meet 9 points, because that's my goal, I want to get all my production systems to 9 points. For my production systems that don't have 9 points, then I may have to start thinking about, okay, are there certain fields where I know I'm going to have this production system where I'm going to have to think about, okay, how else can I identify if I have fields? Which fields have grass waterways? Because now those are going to have additional points. Which fields have filter strips? So I think that if you start, I kind of think about it as a funnel. So if you start at the top and you think big, and that would be those grouped production systems, then at the end, you're going to get down to maybe 5 or 6 fields where you may have to go out and do it field by field, and you may have to do additional things.
So is there a particular production system in the trial runs that you've done, whether it's on your dad's farm or for other farms, if you've done that many for other farms, I guess I don't know. Any production system you're like, oh, this one in particular is probably going to be really difficult to meet the standard? Like, in my mind, for Wisconsin, I think of potatoes and how they manage potatoes being a pretty difficult one.
Yeah, any of your what I've seen is any of your dug crops. So any, so if you're having to do soil disturbance or maybe no-till or strip-till just don't fit in very well for whatever that reason is, or maybe cover crops don't fit in as well. I think those are going to be, I think the other place is because of the irrigation water management mitigation in there, in order to get points for irrigation water management, you have to be using some sort of technology that helps you determine how much water to put out there. And so I think that for your irrigated growers, they need to really make sure to read that or work with their trusted advisor to read those that definition to see how they need it and if they can, because that is a place they that there is that place where you're not getting enough that irrigated land. So if you're a pivot irrigator who really isn't using sensors or any kind of scheduling technology, that's going to be a little bit harder because you're not going to get those points for irrigation water management. You may get po a point for watering in your product. You can get a point for using irrigation to water in your product, which is great, but it's very different than the 3 points you're getting for being a dry land grower.
Sure. So ultimately, we've talked a lot about the strategies, where it's coming from. I guess the big question is, whose job is it to enforce this? It's probably not an honor system, but maybe a little bit. I mean, what do we have an idea of what that's going to look like, or is that still kind of part of the process being developed, or?
So we, I always start with the labels of law.
Yeah.
And so what I've been telling other people and what I've talked about in North Carolina and other locations is that the people who regulate your pesticide labels in your state now are the same people. It's not going to change. So that really is up to the state lead agency. And so if that's the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, that's who will continue to do that. So it really is up to the state lead agency to decide how they're going to enforce the pesticide labels just like they do now. And so those are conversations that are going on within those groups. But because that is state by state, because EPA does not do that is the job of the state lead agencies. It's going to continue to be the state lead agencies that are going to implement and going to enforce those pesticide labels just like they do now.
Okay, so they're not creating a new division of enforcement or anything. It's just the initial or the existing process is just going to have to adapt to the changes being made to the labels.
Yeah, and it's really understanding those labels so that if you are checked, right, if you do come up and you are checked by the state lead agency, that you're not caught off guard, right? Because labels, you don't always know that labels change, right? You're not getting a text message that's saying, hey, your label has been updated. And so it is, you do, there is some level of having to check those labels to make sure that they haven't changed, because that's what we might see, especially new products, I think, are different, right? Because it's a new product, you haven't used it before, you're going to read the label. But let's say you go grab a jug of atrazine, right? You've been using atrazine for the last 30 years. You ask for atrazine, you don't even look at the label because you've been using it for the last 30 years. Probably should look at the label, right? So
Right.
that's, I think that's the key message is that just because it's a product that you've been using for a long time, because it's an older product, it could have gone through registration review and you didn't know it, and all of a sudden something changed and you want to be in compliance.
Is that something we can add to Bulletins Live too, is a text that'll tell you when the label changes? Wouldn't that be
So
nice?
Bulletins Live 2 is an interesting thing. So I think Bulletins Live 2 is only going to be related to those products that have species, like those geographically specific mitigations. So that's what we haven't really touched on. But if we think about, so we've got our label language, and EPA has said that the language related to Bulletins Live 2, so telling you to go look at Bulletins Live 2, will be placed on every outdoor use product. So regardless of whether or not it has a bulletin, that Bulletins Live 2 language will be placed on all outdoor use pesticides. So that means that a grower or an applicator or their advisors will have to go look at Bulletins Live 2 to see if there's a pesticide use limitation area for that product in that geographic area. We know that they're in the process of revising those geographic areas through revising the core map so that those areas, right now, they're very large. So if you go in there and look and you look at Wisconsin, it is covered by a lot of pesticide use limitation areas, but it's not a lot of products, right? And I think that's the key, that just because there's a pesticide use limitation area, it doesn't mean that's applicable to every product. It's only applicable to the products that are listed in Bulletin Slide 2. And I know that has been some confusion, right? Is that we talk about these pesticide use limitation areas, people open it up and they're like, holy smokes, this is awful. I've got all this whole area is covered. Well, it's only covered if you want to use cyanotranilipril, right? Or it's only covered if you want to use, say, sulfoxaflor, right? I think those two are in there. I think they both have pesticide use limitation areas in Wisconsin. So I think that's a really important point, is just because there's a pesticide use limitation area in Bulletin Slide 2 does not mean that it's for every product. It's going to be product by product. And we are hoping that they do come up with a schedule to refine those, the ones that are already in there that need to be refined based on their process, that they do refine those that are already in there so that it's more protective of the area that actually needs to be protected instead of
Sure.
just the entire range of the species.
That's great to know, Leah, because yeah, you pull that map up right now, and some of those lines just seem, I wouldn't say they're to county borders, but they're to townships or to certain things that
Yes.
wouldn't make a lot of sense to being truly specific for that endangered species we want to protect. So that's good to know that those will be continually be refined. What do you think the first step? It feels like as we're talking, there's sort of what I would maybe say three big steps. One is your mitigation strategies. Two is reread the label or check the label. And then three is the going to bulletins live too. Maybe my question is, what order do you think farmers should do those in, and what does that process maybe look like?
So I think what I've been suggesting to people is even if they aren't going to use Liberty Ultra, go in and read the label for Liberty Ultra. It's going to give growers a good idea of what's coming. They may be more complicated for other products that have a larger label, right? I mean, we're only talking about a few crops. So I think that to me is a good first step is familiarize yourself with a label that actually has the language on there. So if you start with the language and understand sort of how EPA is changing how they're talking about it, the additional things that you might see on a label, that's a good example because it's really the only one we have. And so understanding that label, and then once you understand that label, then go in and be able to think about, okay, how do I meet those points? Because I think that's the newest part of all of this, right? Like Bulletin Slide 2 is not new. It's been there. I mean, if people have been using dicamba, they should have been looking at Bulletin Slide 2. So Bulletin Slide 2 is not new, but it might be new to some people, right? So if you haven't been using a product that had that language on there, you maybe haven't ever gone to it. But I would still start with read a label that has it on there, which is the Liberty Ultra one. Go through those production to figure out runoff and erosion, like what that looks like. And then I think you got to just read your labels, like monitor them, right? I mean, sometimes it's just looking at the date, right? Especially on those older products to see when it's been updated. So if it's been updated since 2025, pretty good chance that you might need to look and see if there's new language on it. So just looking at the date on your label to see when it's been updated. And then I think you can get a good idea in Bulletin Slide 2 now, like just play with it, right? Go in there, find your farm. See where you're located, see if you are in any PULAs right now, because some of the species that already have pesticide use limitation areas will continue to have pesticide use limitation areas, right? Like they will continue to have more products that will likely have pesticide use limitation areas. So I think that to me, it's understanding what EPA is doing through reading a label. Think about your production system and how many points you can easily get without doing anything new. And then watch what's happening so you can see with labels as they start to change. And I think it's most important for the new products because that's going to be where you're going to see it the fastest. I mean, nothing's fast right now. Everything's real slow. But it's going to come out most quickly on new products and new uses. So if you're recommending a new product to someone or a grower is using a new product, that's a new product, meaning something that's come out since that will be coming out in the next year. Definitely look at those products pretty closely.
Since we're talking about labels, it came up at the NAACC annual meeting, and it's something that I think we as agronomists would really like to see, because we have a hard enough time reading labels. I know farmers really enjoy reading labels too. Do you think they'll ever like standardize some of the label language, like have the mitigations in a specific spot? It's always going to be, section C or whatever of the label, or is there any traction that you've seen on that? Is that would be very helpful, I think, for a lot of people just to be able to look at a label and know where to look, especially.
I think that there's been, I think WSSA, the Weed Science Society of America, I think they've had some conversations. I think there are people out there who think that's a good idea, and but I don't know how far that's gone, right? Like I don't know what the where that is right now. There also has been a push in the past, and it sort of always comes about every so often is electronic labeling, right? So it's not paper, it's electronic. So those things are talked about and they've been discussed. And I know that there are people who have been working on trying to figure out a standardized labeling, but how that's going to happen and the timeline of that, I don't know. But it is hard. I mean, my brother just called me the other day and we had a whole discussion about finding what kind of nozzle we needed for a certain product. And it took both of us, and I read labels for a living. So it took both of us to find the nozzles on a label, and so I get it. Like I understand, it is hard sometimes because they're all different. They're not all the same.
I'll download them on my phone and be like flipping through and looking for something, and usually overshoot it just because even the formatting of how they put the information in can be very different from one label to the next. So,
They can be very long, and then when you add on bulletins live too. So when you're thinking about like record keeping and all of that information, like you're thinking about your label, and then you've got bulletins live too. And for some areas of the country, like the Pacific Northwest, they've had bulletins for a very long time because of the salmon. And so they can have like if you printed out all their bulletins, it's like over 80 pages when you go through all the different
Jeez.
products, all the different products, all the different species, or not species, but all the different areas. So yeah, it starts to get, that's where I think it for growers, it can get overwhelming, right? Is just the sheer amount of information. And Todd, I really like your question about what's the first step. And I think that not getting overwhelmed, I think, would have been what I should have said as my first step is that don't panic. Like, there are people out there trying to simplify who are trying to help growers like yourself, right? Bring information to them. We're trying to do that of being able to help both the regulated community and the regulators understand the complexity of all of this and just the complexity of farming. And this just adds another layer to it. So.
One good, and I agree with you on that, Leah, is this feels like a very soft release of a rule. I mean, we've had rules that come and basically, it's every herbicide or every whatever is, being changed in the regulation. This is going to change very, as restaurants have like that soft opening thing and a hard opening. I don't
Yes.
really understand that world. This is like an extremely soft opening of years of as labels change. If I have that correct, right, Leah? So I like your
Yes.
wording of not panic. It's almost maybe going to feel like you're going to hear a lot about it right now as a farmer, and then you might think it went away or something just because of how slow the release is.
Yes, it's not self-implementing. That's something the EPA said, and that's something we typically say a lot is that this is not self-implementing. So it's going to be a slow roll. It's not going to all come out at one time, which is great because if it did, that would be awful, right? So I think that that soft release is really great, is that we're going to be able to take these really one product at a time, right? Because we haven't really seen anything come out from EPA in first quarter. And so we know that, and it might be we get five new products at one time to look at. But until, because this really isn't a rule, right? Like this is just policy. And so it's just their strategy of how they're going to do it. It's flexible and they can change it. And that's the difference between something that is more rigid, like a rule would be, where they have to go through the process of changing it. Whereas the strategy is something that's more flexible. So the Vulnerable Species Action Plan, which we haven't talked about, but that's the 27 species that EPA identified are most vulnerable. That action plan has changed, right? Like they are kind of always changing that as they get more information. And so I think that what we're going to see, that's one of the things we're going to see, is as we see labels roll out, but we have to see how they're going to apply this, right? Like that's what we haven't seen. We have to see how they're going to apply the herbicide strategy, how they're going to apply the insecticide strategy, the consistency between products, because they have different teams. They've historically had different teams work on different products. So we need to see the consistency in what those labels look like to be able to feel really confident in how they're going to apply the herbicide strategy to different herbicides. So that's one thing we really don't know. That's one of those uncertainties. But that's why we can't panic, right? Because we don't know until we actually see them start to apply it more on labels.
Yeah, that's something that we've been talking about for probably over 2 years between NAICC and some other things. But now we're really starting to see it locally pop up in news articles. I think BASF, because of Liberty Ultra in particular, is looking to put together some trainings and that kind of stuff, which I think is good. Is there any resources that you've seen that would be valuable in helping people understand this other than calling you or having you on a podcast?
So the Weed Science Society of America has a website where they have some information they've put up there. We are working on, we have a tool that's publicly available, and it's a resource to be able to go in and find presentations and information that's already been put together by other people that you can look at. I think talking to, like, the fact that people have trusted advisors, right, that they can talk to who have been thinking through this. I think Extension is slowly starting to pick up. I know there's a number of people in different states who are really working to get information out there. I think that there's more of a, I think right now we are trying to figure out, okay, where is a central location? Who do people go to talk to? Because right now it is very disjointed. Aside from just the people you normally ask questions to. But I do think that it is really easy to, because it is complicated, it is easy to have some confusion, especially in the timeline and the requirements. So I think the best thing to do is just have conversations about it and ask questions. But we are working to put together a resource so that people can go to one place and find presentations and videos and all of that information. And it's live. It just isn't fully populated yet. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's good to know that things are coming. Like I said, in the state, we've seen it a little bit too, in particular, I think, related because of Liberty Ultra. And Liberty, I think, is a pretty good product to start with because it's used enough. I mean, it's been gaining use, especially with dicamba being vacated. It kind of became a more important herbicide. But it's not like a Roundup where it's used on a lot of different things where it would affect everything all at once.
Well, and this is interesting too. It's Liberty Ultra that is, but
right.
Old Liberty it's is old not yet. So it still has this very
this
unique
is an isomer. I had to ask somebody to help me with this because it's an isomer. Like it's a brand new active ingredient.
Right.
So it's like glufosinate L, I think.
Right.
Yep. And so it's the isomer. And that's way too I'm an economist. Like that's getting into another level of information that I have to hold into my head. But yeah, so it does not impact all the other glufosinate products, right? Like those labels have not changed. The only label that's going to have the herbicide strategy on it would be Liberty Ultra, the new product.
Leah, sometimes farmers or any group, doesn't like to feel picked on about one thing. And you had briefly mentioned that rodenticide also has a mitigation strategy and eating relief points. So so that it's not just sort of one thing in FIFRA that they've looked at. It's all of this has potential changes.
Yes, and the other, so right now the herbicide strategy and the insecticide strategy are just for, they're related to agriculture, so agricultural use. The Vulnerable Species Action Plan, that is every product, all uses. So that would apply to every product, all uses. The rodenticide would be all uses of rodenticides, whether it's agriculture, whether it's commercial, whether it's residential. That strategy is being applied to rodenticides for all uses. And that, once we see them apply that strategy and we start to see that on labels, hopefully we did see some improvements between the draft and the final for that one too, because there were some pretty big ones in there that would impact a lot of areas. And so what we do know is that with Fish and Wildlife, they have to address all uses. So once a product gets to consultation, they're not looking just at agriculture. If you look at the malathion, if you look at the pesticide use limitation areas for malathion, there are several pesticide use limitation areas that are just for mosquito control. So mosquito control was driving the risk associated with that product. It wasn't agriculture. And so in some cases it was. But so I think we have to remember that while we are talking a lot about agriculture, the ESA is not applied just to agriculture. It's applied to all uses of the product, whether that's right of ways, residential use, like all of those at some point will be evaluated under ESA.
I'm sure the residential stuff will go over really well. I'm sure that'll be no problem.
I never thought of mosquitoes. Yeah, because there's a lot of stuff.
A lot of people that apply some sort of
Mosquito
treatment
bomb.
for mosquitoes. Yeah.
Well, and I think that residential is a lot, to me, a lot harder because the use sites are everywhere, right? You're not
Right.
talking about an area that you can easily define. But residentials can be handled a little differently, right? So you can change your product site, you can change your packaging size, you can change some of, you can handle it differently
Yeah.
than you do agriculture where you have wide use of their products. And mosquito control, because it's a human health question, it also is a little bit different, but the mosquito control districts, which is really the people doing the majority of bulk mosquito control, that's really where it's targeted. In a lot of cases, they're already working with Fish and Wildlife anyway.
Sure.
And so it is complicated in a different way than agriculture is. Yeah.
I think one exciting thing about this is agriculture can be part of the solution here, which is really neat.
Yes.
Can be part of bringing species off the list, changing them from endangered to threatened or something like that, and really being part of the solution, which is very exciting and should be. And I think as farmers, they usually do take pride in being stewards of the land and trying to watch out for maybe a species they didn't know was around their farm at all, and is something that they can be helped part of the solution.
And I think that especially in Wisconsin, where you've had, with your streams and your trout streams, there's already a lot of conservation out there because of just the type, your landscape, preserving your soil, making sure it stays where it is. Also, I think with because you do your outdoor activities are so important to you. I think that being able to make sure that they're there and protected is really important. And I think it changes the conversation you have and as compared to other places where maybe it's not been a priority or the landscape is just different, right? I mean, Kansas is very different than Wisconsin. And so their concerns and how they've been addressing their resource concerns might be different, where they may not be doing the same conservation practices because of the landscape. It just changes the conversation we have depending on where you are in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we appreciate you taking the time this morning, Leo. We don't want to keep you all day. I'm sure we could talk about this for hours, but we appreciate you taking us through the process here. And I definitely learn something new every time, and especially the rodenticide stuff. It's interesting to think about how it affects other aspects outside of agriculture. So thank you.
Well, it was a pleasure, always.
All right. Well, thank you for listening as well, and that'll do it for today. Happy farming.